The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you for joining us. Again, follow the show. DanProftShow.com is the website. You can get podcasts there as you can on iTunes and Spotify. And on social media at Dan Proft Show, Facebook, Twitter, at least until I get tagged the way President Trump did. And we start on this edition of the program by talking about the ongoing unrest in Minneapolis and a couple aspects of it that are particularly peculiar to me, and I think bear some a deep discussion, which is the response to the video of the officer on George Floyd's neck, the officer who killed George Floyd, the officer that, you know, based on the evidence that I've seen, should be charged in the murder of George Floyd. And there's a lot of agreement on that view based on the video evidence. And based on law enforcement professionals weighing in, saying what he did was inappropriate. That's not how police are trained. You have a suspect in your custody, under your control. He is handcuffed and he's on his stomach. The first thing you do is turn him on his side so that he doesn't asphyxiate. So the reactions, though, regardless of the consensus, is what's interesting. One of the reactions from the way the press corps is covering it, and this purposeful conflation of rioters with protesters. There are people protesting in the Reverend Martin Luther King tradition of peaceful protesting and petitioning their government for redress. And then there are people burning down other people's businesses and homes and engaging in violence that has nothing to do with justice. In fact, is just an expression of injustice. So why reports like this from Ali Velshi on the front lines in Minneapolis, MSNBC, standing in front of a burning building saying this.
I want to be clear in how I characterize this. This is mostly a protest. It is not generally speaking, unruly, but fires have been started and there's a crowd that is.
You know, usually arson is sort of a signature indication of unruliness at minimum. Oh, by the way, if it's not unruly, then why has the National Guard been called in by your Democrat, not your, but Minnesota's Democratic governor? I mean, of course you have. I mean, you've got a dozen buildings burning, and he's saying it's generally not unruly. Separate the protesters from the rioters. That's the responsible way to cover it. It's a responsible way to distinguish between responses. So why? And then this exchange, also on MSNBC. Boy, you don't think there's any editorial direction here between one of their fungible socialist facilitators on the news desk, news in quotation marks, and Representative Ilhan Omar, hailing from Minnesota, weighing in on the topic.
And what some have pointed out as a sharp contrast between the protest that we saw last night with the police using rubber bullets, tear gas, police in riot gear, with the scenes of armed protesters that we've seen over the past couple of weeks pushing for reopenings at state capitals, in some cases, folks with guns and the police reacting to those for the most part nonviolently, without any tear gas, without any desire to try to disperse them. How do you process that? How do you explain that for people who are watching this contrast in America today?
There's really no way to process that. There is no way to make sense of that. There is no way for us to justify how a police department can look at protesters with guns threatening the lives of lawmakers and not show up with riot gear and with aggression. But when they see young people who are screaming for justice because they just watched a community member get the life choked out of him, they act with extreme aggression. There is no way to justify that. The only explanation for that is to look at the kind of extreme injustices we have in our society. Who is deemed valuable and who isn't? Whose rights are protected and whose rights are not?
Everybody's rights are protected, and then the response to peaceful protesters or rally goers is different than the response to violent ones. Is that so complicated? I mean, the rally goers they're referencing, they show up, those who have showed up to rallies carrying guns, well, they've done so legally. That's why there hasn't been an incident. What buildings have they burned down? And by the, so the rally goers, the analogy is actually to the protesters. The rally goers and the protesters have something in common. The rally goers and the rioters have nothing in common, just as the rioters and the protesters have nothing in common. You see the difference? Is it so complicated? So why force it through that prism? White cop, black suspect. White, largely, rally goers, black protesters, and rioters. Not exclusively, but that's the setup that they're driving. They want this to be a divisive white-black issue, even when there's consensus, even when you have rednecks standing with black folks in front of a tobacco store saying, we want justice for George Floyd, but we also don't think somebody's business should be burned down who had nothing to do with George Floyd's death. Those two thoughts, one can hold simultaneously. They are not in conflict, but they seem to be when it comes to Representative Omar. For more on this, all of this, we're pleased to be joined by Bob Woodson again. He's the founder and president of the Woodson Center, the organizer of the 1776 Project, 1776 Unites, which is a response to the 1619 Project, and somebody who dates back to the civil rights era of the 1960s. Bob, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Pleased to be here, Dan.
So what about this, effort to make comparisons between how rioters are treated versus how reopen rally goers are treated, the comparisons as well, and most notably in the New Yorker, between the Cooper versus Cooper in Central Park and George Floyd and this police officer in Minneapolis. Everything, it seems to me, is the effort is to present this as whites versus blacks.
So this is a continuation of the narrative on the left. When they use the coronavirus to talk about inequities in that. And now every opportunity to emphasize conflict in a difference, they're using this riot. I think your analysis there is exactly right. They are equating protesters with rioters. And I think that the mayor has conspired in this also. He's aiding and abetting anarchy. I've never heard of a mayor having his police department abandon a police precinct building and then letting rioters take it over. This is anarchy. And yet he's permitting, aiding and abetting it when he's expressed sympathy for the rioters. They're not listening to the voices of Ford's mother, who painstakingly says this is not the way to seek justice for her son's death. Also, they're not listening to the neighbors who live in that neighborhood who complain that these are stores that they have to get. There are some comparisons with Ferguson in this. In Ferguson, 51 people were arrested for rioting. Only one was from Ferguson. And there is a report that I saw that said the same thing. The first day, the protesters were peaceful. But then there was indication that another group arrived who then engaged in violence. And they said the two groups seem to be different. And so I really think this is an attempt on the part of the left to just continue to throw stones at our nation, continue to use race as a battering ram to undermine our democracy, and that we have to stand up against these rioters and not equate them with peaceful protesters.
When we come back with Bob Woodson, since you have the historical perspective to provide, I want to do a little comparison in terms of where we are at with race relations as compared to where we were 50 years ago and what the progression or regression has been recently. More with Bob Woodson, founder and president of the Woodson Center, right after this. So take these broken wings and learn to fly again. Learn to live so free. When we hear the voices sing, the book of love will open up and let us hear. Take these broken wings.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And before we get back to Bob Woodson, I wanted to hear another voice. This is Diane Binns. She is the former president of the NAACP chapter in St. Paul. And this was her in a candid moment in a Target parking lot that was overrun by looters. She showed up to Target because she needed to get medication for her daughter. And this is what she said.
So one more day, or maybe longer than that, before she gets her medication. That's why I came up here.
What does St. Paul got to
and
do?
And all this up is up here. And St. Paul ain't got to do with what happened. We ain't got nothing to have to do. And these people don't give a damn about George Floyd, because they took and fired the police officer. They're going to charge them when the investigation is over.
They got the FBI investigating him.
That's right.
Come on,
so hell, leave this alone. These motherfuckers need to go home.
Need to go home because she wants to get medicine for her daughter just like anybody would. And it seems to me it's a good another case study of the law-abiding and the peaceful have a lot more in common across race than those law-abiding do with the non-law-abiding, even though it's being presented conversely by the press corps, which is just so frustrating. For more on this, we're rejoined by Bob Woodson, the founder and president of the Woodson Center and the founder as well, the 1776 Unites effort to combat the 1619 Project, which we'll get to. Bob, what about what Ms. Binns, the former NAACP chapter president in St. Paul, had to say?
Unfortunately, the voice of the people suffering the problems in the neighborhoods are never given a microphone to express themselves because the press refuses to cover them. Again, just like in Ferguson, they shot at the public buses, which meant that low-income people in the affected neighborhood were actually cut off. Food, water had to be taken into them because they didn't have cars, they didn't have stores to shop in because they'd been burned down. But a few of the young men in the neighborhood who worked in those stores armed themselves and stood in front of one store and refused to allow those rioters in, and that store was saved. But it was protected by three low-income black young men who worked there and protected that store, armed protectors of the store. But you didn't hear about them. They were not interviewed as to their feelings about the experience there. So what we're doing at 1776 at the Woodson Center is really giving voice to the people suffering the problem, not these race grievance leaders that you see on television giving aid and comfort to the rioters. Because they don't have to live in those communities that are suffering these kind of assaults. Another issue that isn't dealt with, the fact that this vilification of the police, where you stereotype because of the actions of a very few, you stigmatize the entire law enforcement, which means that recruitment is down 60% throughout the country. And in some cases, police can't even respond to 911 calls because they don't have enough officers. So we are really courting disaster if steps are not taken to confront this assault on law and order and assault on our country.
Well, and so where are we? I mean, you were part of the civil rights movement in the 60s. And now, as we look 50 years later, after landmark legislation has been passed and racist institutions as a matter of law, de jure institutions like Jim Crow are a thing of the past. The police relationship with minority communities is much different, in part because you have so many more minority police officers around the country. And yet there's an ideological movement that says whiteness is the root of all evil in America. It needs to be expunged. And police and other institutions created by the whites are expressions of that oppression. And we're not going to stop until we, you know, fully divide for the purposes of exploitation, that we're going to, you know, engender love ultimately by hating what we should hate, which is whiteness.
Well, I just think that, again, those views are not shared by low-income people in these communities. And there were several surveys done over 12 years of the views of low-income or ordinary Americans, black Americans, and only 8% identify race as critical. But you have a class of so-called black liberal political leadership that they fan the flames of racial animosity, because as long as they can blame white people, they don't have to explain why blacks have been failing in systems run by their own people for the past 40 years. All of these failures and the violence is deposited in cities run by liberal black Democrats for the past 40 years. So as long as they can keep the country's attention on racial discrimination, they don't have to explain why poor blacks are failing in systems run by their own people. While the people who serve the low-income people, they're profiting. The biggest income gap, Dan, is not between whites and blacks. It's between low-income blacks and upper-income blacks.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, if racism were the defining issue, why are not all blacks suffering equally? Why do you have some class of middle-class blacks whose incomes are prospering at a time when their black counterparts are getting worse?
I want to play a clip from George Floyd's brother, Philanese Floyd, who was on CNN. He said something about the rioters, and I don't mean to pick on him. I know he's grieving, and I'm not going to hold him to any particular standard. But he just said something that is a caricature that I want you to address, because I think it's so troubling.
It's just like a child searching for attention. They're doing everything positive, and nobody's listening. And all of a sudden, they just start acting out. So I want, you know, everybody to be peaceful right now. But people are torn and hurt because they're tired of seeing black men die constantly.
I understand people are torn and hurt. But the thing that bothers me about what he said is this idea of comparing them to children acting out. It's the infantilization of adults. We're largely talking about adults here. And I think stripping agency from adults is about the most insulting thing you can do. And this happens all the time with respect to blacks by largely the white media.
It really does. It's the most demeaning that you can have. And that's like the 1619 Project. All of those, you know, all of these whites who get on television and say, well, we understand why blacks riot or why, because they've been victims of discrimination. Nothing is more demeaning than to deny, than provide a convenient excuse for someone to fail. It's nothing is more debilitating than that, and that's what race. But race is really a cover for the failures of black politicians in these cities. And as long as they can keep the attention riveted on institutional racism, and I don't know what that means. Does that mean white people operate by remote control and causes black folks to miseducate their children or poorly serve them? I don't know what that means, but it's a game that some of us are trying to confront. But we at 1776, that's a problem that has to be solved within the black community, and we are trying to mobilize resources so we can marshal the voices of reasonable people in there who are suffering in these neighborhoods because they don't have stores to attend to frequent. They don't have the resources. So we're going to do everything we can to compete with the voices of despair and anger and protest with the voices of reasonable people who just want America to live up to its promise, and America is.
He is Bob Woodson, founder and president of the Woodson Center, as well as the 1776 response to the 1619 Project. Check it all out. Check it out and get involved. Bob Woodson, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
That's what I said now. Princess who adore you.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. President Trump yesterday, from the Oval Office, explaining the basis for the executive order he put his John Hancock on.
The choices that Twitter makes when it chooses to suppress, edit, blacklist, shadow, ban, are editorial decisions, pure and simple. They're editorial decisions. In those moments, Twitter ceases to be a neutral public platform and they become an editor with a viewpoint. And I think we can say that about others also, whether you're looking at Google, whether you're looking at Facebook, and perhaps others.
Mm-hmm. And so you get the sense of where he's going. It's redefining the types of operators these social media companies are. They're publishers because they're editing with a viewpoint. And so he offers this comparison to, say, Yo Ma Bell.
The censorship and bias is a threat to freedom itself. Imagine if your phone company silenced or edited your conversations. Social media companies have vastly more power and more reach than any phone company in the United States. More reach, actually, than your newspapers, by far. More reach than a lot of your traditional forms of communication. Therefore, today I'm signing an executive order to protect and uphold the free speech and rights of the American people. Currently, social media giants like Twitter receive an unprecedented liability shield based on the theory that they're a neutral platform, which they are not, an editor with a viewpoint. My executive order calls for new regulations under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act to make it that social media companies that engage in censoring or any political conduct will not be able to keep their liability shield. That's a big deal.
Hmm. Flip side of the argument that Trump is making was articulated by the Wall Street Journal editorial board. Facebook, YouTube and Twitter aren't utilities or soapboxes in the park. They're businesses that earn piles of money by selling ads against your missives. They're within their rights to set community standards and spike posts they deem a violation. If this feels suffocating, log off. That includes you at Real Donald Trump. He was asked that question, I think, by Jonathan Carl, and here's his answer about why not just walk away if you don't like it.
Well, you know, if you weren't fake, I would not even think about it. I would do that in a heartbeat.
I'm real,
but the news is fake. If you look at what it gets printed in newspapers, if only the public could understand where, you know, they're reading a story and they think it's real and it's not real in so many cases. And I'm not saying in every case. You have some great journalists. You have some journalists that I have great respect for. But largely, I find, at least in a political sense, there's so much fake news, it's disgraceful. I would do that in a heartbeat if I had fair. If we had a fair press in this country, I would do that in a heartbeat. There's nothing I'd rather do than get rid of my whole Twitter account. But I'm able to get to, I guess, 186 million people when you add up all the different accounts and add Facebook and Instagram. It's a lot of people. And that's more than the media companies have, frankly, by a lot. And so if I get a story that's wrong, I can put a social media. I don't usually use the word Twitter. I say social media. But I put something out, and the next day or the next hour or the next minute, everybody's reading about it. So I'm able to refute fake news, and that's very important.
Well, there's what they should do normatively and what they should be forced to do under color of law. That's the discussion. And I'm not sure Trump's last argument there in response to the question about why not walk away is a particular compelling one. But let's take this up with Kalev Lataru, who is a Real Clear Media fellow and senior fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. Kalev, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Is Kalev or Kalev?
Kalev.
All right. Sorry, I didn't want to mispronounce your name in the whole letter. Kalev. The last piece of what Trump said about this, you know, if the old media weren't so biased against me, then I would walk away from Twitter. Well, that's not really an argument on the merits of whether Twitter should be considered a publisher and should be stripped of its immunity, is it?
That's the thing. And, you know, obviously, you know, this morning we have Twitter. Twitter obviously doesn't seem to fear this executive order, as, you know, this morning they actually hid a presidential tweet. You know, literally, you go to the president's Twitter account, and one of his tweets now, you don't see the tweet. You see a box over it saying that we haven't deleted this because we think it's historically important, but you have to go through this. You know, you actually have to click here to view it, and here's why this is a violation. And I think this is, you know, again, the fact that Twitter, why this tweet? I mean, why this week, I think, is the question. You know, as you point out, all kinds of falsehoods on Twitter that you would think would want to be fact-checked, all kinds of commentary that might raise questions. Why this week and why these two tweets?
When we come back with Kalev Lataru, I want to pick up on the point of recategorizing social media platforms as publishers and how that impacts their immunity protections. More with Kalev Lataru next.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Kalev Lataru. I want to go back to the point you were making about the fundamental discussion as a matter of law here about Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. But it's about whether through legislation, which President Trump will probably need animating legislation, and he's going to get from Josh Hawley and Matt Gaetz in the Senate and the House respectively, but whether or not this is a proper redefinition of the social media platforms and the basis for that redefinition. Are you persuaded by President Trump's argument that because they flag, they set community standards and they're flagging some tweets and not others, even if they're similarly untrue, that they are now a publisher, they are now an editor, they shouldn't be afforded the immunity protections that they've enjoyed up until this point?
It's fascinating because you could publish an entire library of all the books and papers that have been written by legal scholars, you know, on this very issue of, you know, at what point do they cross the line? Essentially, this is that fascinating question. And you can see it from both sides. You can see the company saying, well, look, the law is pretty specific that it pretty much exempts almost anything. But you could see on the other hand to say, you know, yes, you can argue the legal specifics, but you could say, look, this law didn't anticipate, you know, it was basically designed for a very narrow set of circumstances. It never envisioned that social media companies would start wading in and saying the president of the United States has said something we disagree with, so we're going to hide that. Really, I think when you start doing this to official U.S. government elected officials, I think that really crosses a line that I think is a really troubling one, whether or not the legal scholars agree with that. And of course, this will be litigated in the courts. But I do think as a society, we have to ask that question. This really crosses a line when it comes to the underpinnings of democracy.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that you set forward community standards in terms of service, and then you enforce them as you see fit based on your interpretation of your standards. Remember, we're talking about a private company. We're not talking about government. I hear what you're saying about sort of the compelling public interest legal argument that a president of the United States has to communicate to his constituents. But that's a dangerous precedent to set, too, because then you have the speech rights of politicians potentially at every level of government being elevated over the free speech rights of ordinary Americans or non-office holding Americans. It seems to me that the easiest way to do this is just go back to what I said before, said, here are our principles, here are our standards, here are our community guidelines, and we're going to enforce them to the best of our ability. Otherwise, let people hash out true, untrue opinion fact in these exchanges that occur organically on social media platforms.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's very easy to write a rule. For example, if you say, we're going to ban any speech that is offensive. You know, it's easy to write these rules, or actually terrorism is a perfect example. You say, we're going to ban any terroristic speech. That sounds really simple. That sounds like a fantastic rule. until you see governments in other parts of the world say, you know, just with a scratch of a pen, say any criticism of our government is terrorism.
Right.
Now all government criticism gets deleted. Or similarly, you know, I've written extensively about how the social media companies, again, they have a lot of these rules about, you know, acceptable speech. And one of the challenges is because these are global companies, it means that they have to essentially come up with a set of rules that work for the entire planet. And when you look at the global scale, something is going to upset at someone somewhere. And the question is, where do you draw these lines? It's very simple to write a set of rules that the first time you read them, it sounds, yeah, this is great. This is fantastic. This is really going to get rid of the trolls and the things we want to get rid of. But the problem is, in practice, these are very difficult rules. Is this like Trump's tweet today? You know, you could say, wow, you know, this has some real bad historical precedent to it. This harkens back to the quote that he used, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. You know, that traces itself back to a really dark time. On the other hand, you might argue and say, well, I think this is the real challenge is society's messy. It's the reason that courts, you know, we have laws, but that's also why we have judges and juries. Because laws, you know, most of society occurs in these fuzzy places that require interpretation. And in our court system, that occurs in public. In social media companies, that's behind closed doors, and we have no visibility into how any of these decisions are made. So I think that's the real tension, is that translation of these rules, which I think we want to get rid of the trolls. We want to get rid of the people that are, you know, just spending their time attacking people and not doing anything useful. But, you know, we need to have transparency into the interpretation of those, you know, the sort of an externalization.
I mean, Sohrab Ahmari makes the point in the Post. This is, you know, basically distills it down. This isn't restricting Twitter's free speech. It's removing their immunity. Here's the deal. If I publish libelous claims in the New York Post, my victims can hold the Post liable in court. But Twitter is immune to such suits under the 96 Communications Decency Act, Section 230, that provides, quote, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. They're a platform, they're a channel, they're not a publisher, and that's the distinction and thus the immunity. He's removing that immunity by policing conservatives and fact-checking the Republican president of the United States, Twitter is acting like a publisher. So why should Twitter not be defined as a publisher? And if it's a publisher, then why should it not face the same legal exposure that the New York Post or any other media outlet faces? That's the argument that's made.
And, you know, it's fascinating because, you know, again, his reference to Ma Bell is one that I've used a lot in the past, which is, you know, you think about it, you know, the telephone company, you know, which, again, the social media companies liken themselves essentially to a glorified telephone system, if you will. But when I pick up the phone and call someone, the, you know, telephone company isn't sitting there monitoring what I'm saying and then disconnecting if I say something they disagree with. There is no editorial function. Social media companies do have that editorial function. But, you know, again, it comes back to that. And that is, I think, a really fascinating point of, you know, with newspapers, with journalism, they are subjective. They do have responsibility for what they say. Social media companies, again, they live in this kind of this weird fairy tale land where they get the best of all possible worlds with no possible consequence. And, you know, I think that's a real challenge. And again, this law was crafted in an era that never anticipated where we are today. And, you know, it was really essentially designed to allow companies to basically step forward. If you have a horrible, you know, troll on there saying really horrific things, I think most of society agrees that, hey, you know, we need to get rid of that. But the problem is that's really what the law kind of envisioned, things like that. But the problem then is, again, it's that interpretation of, well, gee, that protection's pretty absolute the way it's written.
He is Kalev Lataro, who is a Real Clear Media Fellow and Senior Fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. Kalev, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. I wish more politicians would have their COVID-19 briefings outside as the weather becomes nicer. making it more conducive to outside press conferences, because that gives an opportunity for passersby or average Joe citizens to participate, not just the press corps. And their participation tends to be more lively and more cutting to the chase of things. A good example of this, he probably regrets it now, Maryland, Montgomery County, Maryland's county executive, Mark Elrich, he did a briefing outside announcing the phase one reopening of that county of about 1 million people in Maryland. And the residents were there, and they were none too happy with what County Executive Elrich had to say.
Again, these are Governor Hogan's recommendations. Personal services, hair salons, and barbershops open for hair only. No haircuts, no manicures.
The natives are restless. Get out of here.
That's over. 0.26 mortality rate. People can't pay their bills. They can't feed their children.
I mean, I know we've argued on this show that many of the guidelines or the lockdown related requirements are arbitrary and capricious, but I think County Executive Elrich took it to a new level when he said haircuts or barbershops, hair salons will be open, but no haircuts. What are you going to go there to do? Sit on the barber's chair and talk to Cedric the Entertainer? Have your hair combed? And so that threw the whole place up for grabs, and it continued even as Elrich tried to. Not having it.
No government paychecks.
So people are actually interested.
Why did you live on nothing? Yes. I'm here to stay with us. Why are we here? You live on nothing. We're people that work for us. Don't you dare talk to us like that. Four-figure paychecks.
Take your paychecks away,
then
they open it up tomorrow.
Yeah, and the best line, that woman responding to his condescending attitude for the people actually interested, and the facial expressions made it worse if you watch the video. Don't talk to us like that. Exactly. Who the hell are you? Don't you dare talk to us like that. First of all, it's been difficult enough to get any audience with officials hiding behind cover of Zoom screens and pressers where average citizens can't participate. You don't come in here and condescend to me with what you're doing to disrupt my life and the lives of my family members and friends and our community. Absolutely. It's about time that somebody was made an example of rhetorically, and that was County Executive Elrich. More of that needs to come.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us at danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes. Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. Vice President Joe Biden had a big week. He did his first face-to-face interview from a distance of about 60 feet, it looked like, at least on camera, with Dan Bash, CNN. And, one of the things he said.
100,000 deaths. 100,000 deaths. And at least 35,000 to 50,000 were avoidable. But for lack of attention and ego, I think.
I'll tell you what, you want to play this game, this whole like 35 to 50,000 deaths are Trump's fault. This is the same game that Tammy Duckworth and other people tried to play right at the outset before the numbers started to pile up in blue states like New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts, which even though there's a Republican governor in Massachusetts, still the idea is the plurality of deaths and cases exist in two states, New York and New Jersey. The majority of deaths in those three states I mentioned, if you include Massachusetts. you want to talk about nursing home deaths. You want to do the New York, Florida comparison, the Texas, New Jersey comparison. You want to do those comparisons and then say, okay, well, then the deaths that occurred at nursing homes in New York are in Andrew Cuomo, as all the deaths are in New York.
He's trying to belittle you for wearing a mask, making it seem like it's a sign of weakness, is it?
He's a fool, an absolute fool to talk that way. I mean, every leading doc in the world is saying we should wear a mask when you're in a crowd.
Well, first of all, you weren't in a crowd. And, of course, we've talked about the science on masks. And that leads us to our latest contribution from the poet laureate R.A. Droit. The DNC at last had worked its will and threw the race for Mr. Dr. Jill. But Biden, even with the pathway cleared, was not a foe that Donald really feared. His handlers had him locked down in a cell to minimize the gaffes that Joe could tell. But minimizing gaffes would come to naught, as Joe by now could scarce complete a thought. When journos asked, had Flynn committed crime, the Biden answer failed to satisfy. I had no role in prosecuting Flynn, and here's the deal, I know that I can win. Trump lied and got us into Vietnam, and on the Germans dropped the atom bomb. Like Harry Tubman said, the buck stops here, and now the working man can't have a beer. I like to stroke young kids just like Barack, who is my best friend, even though he's black. We need his leadership now, and he'll win. That's all I have to say on General Flynn. Very nice, R.A. Droit. Very, very, very nice. For more on all things Biden and November 3rd related, pleased to be joined by Mark Lauder. He is the Director of Strategic Communications for President Trump's 2020 reelection, former special assistant to Vice President and Press Secretary to Vice President Pence. Lots of titles. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
There are so many titles in there, but none of it was poet. I feel like I'm not worthy.
Yeah, exactly. Next time, make them rhyme or some kind of rhyme scheme. Iambic pentameter. Let's try that. So, Mark, Joe Biden says Trump, you know, per this Columbia site, the New York Times highlighted this week, Trump is responsible for 35 or 50,000 deaths. If he had had more foresight, exercise more leadership, we could have had a lower body count.
I mean, it's not just ludicrous, and it tells you how desperate Joe Biden is if he's trying to claim something like that. Let's remember that this is the same guy who called the president's early action to shut down travel from China as xenophobic and racist when the doctors and the medical experts said it saved lives. And that's really the key here. We could have been upwards of the 1 million, 2 million deaths as was projected had the president not taken the action in closing the borders and then also taking this economy and shutting it down for public health.
Eric Strauss from ABC News, of all places, reporting, looking at 21 states that ease restrictions as of May 4th or earlier, no major increase in hospitalization, deaths, or percentage of people testing positive. None in all 21 states. And that's the basis for President Trump saying the second wave that people are predicting in the fall and the winter, no matter what it looks like, we're not shutting down. And hopefully we'll never shut down again in response to something like this.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I'm walking on the beach in Florida right now because I decided to come down here and enjoy a state that has actually opened up. I'm not wearing a mask and I'm socially distancing, but people are doing it and you can see the life coming back. And I know the president is so right when he says America wants to get back to it. And I said this the other day, that look, this is a country that was founded by people who took a risk and came over to the new world across the ocean. We are the country that tamed the West despite the risks, went to the moon, and actually fought world wars in other people's continents, not because of the risk, but because it was the thing that needed to be done. This country will find a way to open back up safely. We can do it and have a strong, productive economy.
Well, you have a report out that consumer spending is down 13.5% in April, but incomes were up 10.5% because of government stimulus. And so the impact hasn't been felt in a lot of bank accounts yet. But for those states that continue to lock down in significant ways, it will be felt as the benefits start to run out and the financial equation that people face fundamentally changes. And it seems to me that there's a need for the president to continue to push on the blue states and even some of the governors who he has a better relationship in blue states like Gavin Newsom than other governors, because you can't have a full recovery and a quick one if you don't have California, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, Michigan online.
Well, and it's true, and we need these states to reopen and to do it smartly. I have to question whether they're playing politics with it, trying to keep their economies closed to inflict what they would hope to be political pain on the president in November. I think that's what you're seeing in a lot of these states, because as you have said, we have seen states reopen and do it safely without a second wave. And so there's no reason why folks who are able to get out there and work should be able to do so. And folks that are, who are find themselves in the high-risk categories, whether because of pre-existing conditions or if they're older, then they should be able to stay inside. We can do both.
And to your point, a former Obama economic advisor now at Harvard, Jason Furman, at a briefing, a bipartisan briefing that was memorialized in Politico this week, suggested he expects third quarter numbers like we've never seen in American history. I mean, in terms of good, in terms of growth numbers, even if the second quarter is expected to be not particularly pretty. The response from Democrats, at least as, again, reported by Politico, was great concern at what Jason Furman was saying about what the third quarter was going to look like. Why would you be concerned about good economic numbers in the third quarter if it wasn't politics?
No, you're absolutely right. And we have to remember, go back last summer when you had major Democrats saying they hoped for a recession. They needed a recession so Americans could lose their jobs, lose their homes, lose their savings, but that might help them politically. It's really sad, and we've got to get beyond it. I think what we're going to see isn't America getting back to work. You're going to see that growth. And I think the president's going to be reelected because people are going to like that strong leadership.
I wanted to get your reaction to this since Trump taking on big tech is a headline today. This report in Recode where four billionaires in particular have been identified. LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman, Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz, Steve Jobs' widow, and former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, all putting together the digital strategy, if you will, to improve the digital infrastructure that the Democrat Party has in order to defeat Trump in November. And, you know, this is goes back to hearings last year where Dennis Prager, our colleague, was there, and Dr. Robert Epstein was there talking about how Google can manipulate the information flow and potentially influence voters' attitudes and move votes. So the combination of it's not just billionaires, but it's billionaires in the big tech space that have the ability to manipulate information to hundreds of millions of Americans. This has to be a real concern for the reelection campaign.
Well, it's absolutely a concern, although one advantage we have is that we are technologically light years ahead of Democrats and their campaigns. They can't even come close to competing with us, which is another reason why I think they're panicking, not only in terms of their censorship with Twitter and others and big tech, but also trying to just rapidly close the gap. I'll tell you, we put on with the Trump campaign, we put on live events every night, 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central. Each one of those programs is getting over 1 million viewers. Some of them have gotten over 2.5 million viewers, which actually means that we have more viewers than any program on CNN all day and over almost every program than MSNBC.
Well, you know, you should raise the bar. I mean, that's not bad. You're not worried about Facebook and Google being more transparently aggressive the way Twitter has been recently and really trying to shut down Trump's communication channels, or at least their communication channels to the Trump campaign.
One thing I would remind the Facebook and the social media tech companies is that you rely on wireless and cellular wireless frequencies to get your message and your product into people's phones and onto their laptops. And the federal government regulates that, just like they do for radio stations and television stations. And there's no reason, and it's perfectly legal. I'm not a lawyer, but it's perfectly legal for them to take a look at their use of the spectrum as well.
Interesting. All right. He is Mark Lauder. He is the director of strategic communication for President Trump's 2020 reelection campaign. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Good piece in the Wall Street Journal by a former chief of staff to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Josh Holmes is his name. Making the point I've been making on this show for some time that Americans have not felt the full impact of the economic devastation that has been wrought by by the response to the COVID-19 outbreak. They are in a period of hold harmless that is going to end soon, and it is going to fundamentally alter the calculus of tens of millions of Americans. As Josh Holmes writes, neither the stock market nor the political preferences of those who've been hit hardest by the COVID-induced economic crisis have fundamentally changed since the crisis began. Isn't that interesting? 40% of job loss will be permanent, says University of Chicago. A recent Washington Post poll shows 77% of those who lost their jobs believe they will be heading back to the same jobs following the crisis. People are deluding themselves. Why? Because they haven't felt the pain. This has largely been an inconvenience. And for those for whom it has been more than an inconvenience, who have lost their jobs, their optimism is a bit unbounded, as this Washington poll survey indicates. Their delusion has been subsidized by the government because they haven't missed a paycheck yet through unemployment, and particularly the enhanced unemployment. So many more, particularly in the service industry, are making more money on unemployment than they were employed. Josh Holmes writes, if your family hasn't lost a loved one to COVID-19, your bank account probably looks basically the same, and you believe your job is awaiting your return. If you believe all those things, if your account looks the same and you're awaiting, you believe your return is imminent, the 10 weeks have been an extended vacation associated with some inconveniences. And so, and those that are have been completely insulated, those who can easily telework, meaning mainly upper income professionals, a lot of them champagne socialists, which is why he goes back to say, isn't it interesting that the numbers haven't moved? Trump's approval rating, according to Gallup, was 49% on February 16th. And 3 months after the largest job loss in American history, his approval rating is 49%. Same. And of course, the opposition to Trump is also the same. And frankly, the composition of the support in opposition is largely the same. It's remarkable, but it's because, in part, the volatility that is bubbling below the surface has been kept below the surface through $9 trillion worth of government disaster relief. And for those 40 million first-time unemployment filers over the last 9-10 weeks, many of whom are feeling it, you know who's feeling it because you know where you see them? At reopen rallies. You see a lot of them at reopen rallies, which is why you get a cross-section of people politically at those reopen rallies, and they're saying largely the same things. But the general point is that you have an expectation that everything is going to be smooth, and to the extent that you're being pinched right now because of incompetence, because you live in a state with incompetence, bloated, ineffective government like Illinois, you still expect that, you know, you can plan for this money that's coming down the pike at some point. What if you don't have that assurance? Like when the payments stop, if there isn't a phase four check, when the enhanced unemployment benefits go back to the standard issue unemployment benefits, when your job doesn't return. 3/4 of people think they're going back to their job. Many of them are not. And many of those businesses are also not guaranteed to reopen. Oh, by the way, particularly in the service sector, where there's projections of, you know, up to 1 in 4 restaurants that are gone forever. Now, ultimately, there may be new restaurants that come online as the economy recovers and so on and so forth. So, but I mean, that takes time. So are you in it for the next 6 months, for the next year? Holmes concludes his piece saying, unlike previous challenges, the true nature of America's economic crisis hasn't set in on the American people. I completely agree. When it does, the familiar political fault lines fused with millions more unemployed could make 2020 the most explosive ideological election in American history. Yeah, it could. I mean, do you get that sense that people haven't felt the full brunt of it? There was a lot more panic early on. It was a combination of things. And, you know, one sort of drives the other. But it was what the unknown nature of the virus and its lethality combined with dire worst case scenario predictions that drove the stock market down, you know, 40% in a short period of time. Now that you've seen essentially a 50% recovery up near 26,000, it was 18,000 6 weeks ago, the Dow. So people are feeling a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more stable. We're going to be able to ride this out fine. There's no precipice just over the horizon. Maybe. maybe for some, maybe not for millions of others. I don't know how you look at unemployment rates like 21% in Illinois, 33% in Kentucky, and say, yeah, this looks pretty good. We should be fine. Well, and so this leads us to our next guest, Yoram Lass. He's a former director of Israel's health ministry, and he gave a compelling interview to Spiked Online. So wanted to follow up with that. The top line being, nothing can justify this destruction of people's lives. And by the destruction of people's lives, he's talking about the implications of the lockdown approach to combating the COVID-19 outbreak. And again, all of the consequences that maybe we're just beginning to get a sense are going to be visited upon us in the West. For more on this, Yoram Lass, former director of Israel's health ministry, member of the Sackler Faculty of Medicine at Tel Aviv University. Yoram Lass, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
One of the points that you made right at the outset of the interview I referenced was about two viruses, one, COVID-19, the other, the social media networks. And that is a much discussed topic of late. But to just develop how you think the social media networks and the information flow through them exacerbated the incorrect response to the actual virus.
Well, this is the first epidemic in history which is accompanied by what you just mentioned, the social media virus, which changed everything. You see, this corona situation is comparable to the seasonal flu epidemic. Comparable, not the same. But then we did not have Facebook and Instagram and everything, which has changed everything. We have a mental illness. People and governments are hysterical. The response is hysterical. Monstrous hysteria is what we have. Results and the cause is almost biblical. I mean, how can we ruin our own world with our own hands for something which is comparable to flu? The only answer I have is what I just told you.
When we come back with Yoram Lass, I want to ask about the medical doctors and public health professionals who bought into the lockdown prescription, even though they knew or should have known about the assumptions of those models that were the basis of those public policy prescriptions. More with former Israeli health director Yoram Lass coming up next.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
We're back with Yoram Lass discussing the effectiveness of lockdowns, and I want to talk about the medical professionals, whether they're medical doctors or public health professionals, the Centers for Disease Control folks here, you know who they are, epidemiologists and virologists and microbiologists the world over. I mean, there's certainly at minimum divided opinion about the response, many proposing and supporting the idea that locking down, in addition to all the other measures that don't have much of a basis in science, but the scientific professionals are suggesting make the most sense based on what we know. You know, we're advocating for these policies, too, and that provided the cover for the politicians.
Yeah, but look, I speak for myself and for the data I have and for many professionals like myself who support the idea that lockdown is lunacy. The cost is much higher than the benefit. We only begin to feel the cost. I mean, take unemployment. Unemployment is mortality. Think about about the depression, the suicide, the pressure, the high blood pressure, the heart attacks, the crime, the alcohol, the drugs, husbands killing wives. Think about all these results from unemployment. And the unemployment we have is a much a greater danger than the corona.
But
for human lives.
Look, I am in vociferous agreement with you, and I know you only speak for yourself, but I'm trying to see if you can help us understand why you have all of those professionals with all of those credentials, like you have those same credentials, saying something very different about lockdown policies. What should we understand about the industry of epidemiologists and public health professionals and government consultants?
Yeah, okay, let me give you an example. Not from the United States. Professor Ferguson from Imperial College in London. So he and people like him, they come up with models, with exponential models. Now, models, they do not work in biology. There are too many variables in biology. Now, there is a history here. Back in 2009, we had the swine flu epidemic. Perhaps you remember that?
Sure.
Swine flu epidemic of 2009, originating from Mexico. No vaccine, very contagious, at least 250,000 people, if not more, died. And this Ferguson, back in 2009, he suggested a shutdown based on his crazy models. Nobody listened to him. Why? Because back in 2009, people were busy with the financial crisis of 2008. So they did not have the attention to listen to this nonsense. Now, the same Ferguson, same guy, same big professor of 2009 failed. The same guy, he advised the British government 2019, and he succeeded. And you copied the English copied the Italians copied the French, and so on, and they all copied China, which is very exotic. Everything there is exotic. And we came to a point where the world economy is ruined for a very long time. You see, fear and anxiety is a mental situation which is very difficult to treat. People are afraid.
He is Yoram Lass. He's the former director of Israel's health ministry, member of the Sackler Faculty of Medicine at Tel Aviv University. Do check out his interview as well at Spiked Online, which I will tweet out. Yoram Lass, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your perspective.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. Tainted love. Tainted love. Now I know I've got to run away. I've got to get away. You don't really want any more from me to make things right. You need someone to hold you tight. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. When Great Britain turned over control of Hong Kong to China, effectively, in 1997, many predicted that it would be just a matter of time before Hong Kong would no longer be able to operate independently. And it took 23 years, and now we're here, unfortunately, with Secretary of State Pompeo saying that there is no longer one country and two systems in China. As Benedict Rogers writes at The Spectator, the law that prompted the declaration by Secretary of State Pompeo not only destroys Hong Kong's freedoms, insults the international rules-based order, and undermines one of Asia's most open cities, it also directly threatens Hong Kong's status as one of the world's most important international financial centers. Yeah, the Chinese communists and President Xi are circling the wagons, closing ranks, and that includes Hong Kong and the hundreds of thousands, millions at some points, protesters. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Benedict Rogers, human rights activist, journalist, co-founder and chair of Hong Kong Watch. Ben Rogers, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Good to have you here. And so we're at this day that many feared was inevitable under Chinese communist rule. And what are we in the West to do about it?
Well, this is a really tragic time for Hong Kong. You know, one country, two systems really did work for at least the first, let's say, decade or so after the handover. I lived in Hong Kong for the first 5 years after the handover and really thought that this experiment of Hong Kong's high degree of autonomy, albeit under the sovereignty of communist China, was working. But clearly now, as I've written and as you've just described, it is over for one country, two systems, and it's a severe breach of the international treaty that underpins that, the Sino-British Joint Declaration. So I think there is a need for the international community to not just speak out, which has already started to happen. Secretary Pompeo has been followed by the British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, the Canadian and Australian foreign ministers. They've all issued a joint statement, and other governments. But the time is needed not just for words, although they're important, but for concrete actions. And I think Britain needs to lead the way in addressing the fact that an international treaty has been breached. I think our respective countries should be looking at targeted sanctions, not sanctions that will hurt the people and the economy of Hong Kong, but targeted sanctions against officials in Beijing and in the Hong Kong government who are responsible for this, and other measures that we can monitor, promote, protect the human rights of the people of Hong Kong, and also, if necessary, give sanctuary to vulnerable frontline political activists who may need a place of safety if this continues.
What's China's play here? Why the ratcheting up in this way?
First of all, they were very alarmed that in the district council elections last December, the pro-democracy camp in Hong Kong swept the board and won a really astonishing victory in those elections. And I think the pro-democracy camp were very likely to do extremely well in the forthcoming elections to Hong Kong's Legislative Council, which is the closest Hong Kong has to a parliament. I think Beijing could not cope with the idea of Hong Kong's Legislative Council being dominated by pro-democracy groups, and they were prepared to do everything they could to prevent that. Plus, I think they've also taken advantage of the COVID-19 pandemic, which, let's not forget, of course, originated in China, and we should hold the Chinese Communist Party regime, not the Chinese people, but the regime, responsible for this pandemic.
But with respect to China shutting down, kicking out reporters from the West, major outlets in America and others, and you know, on again, off again, shutting down cities to deal with the virus. Now, this measure with respect to Hong Kong and drawing the ire of the West yet again. Do you sense that they still believe that they're on track for global hegemony? It's just going to require maybe more repressive measures than they otherwise wanted to employ, but of course they're willing to employ?
I think that may be part of it. I mean, this regime under Xi Jinping is definitely the most repressive and also ideological that there has been really since the days of Mao. You know, we had 3 decades of China, of course, still under the Communist Party, still being repressive, but nevertheless seeming to want to play a more open and constructive role in the world. And then along comes Xi Jinping, and he has imposed, he's resurrected a personality cult, he's resurrected the ideological ideas of the Communist Party, and he's not only shown the most brutal repression since, well, certainly since the Tiananmen massacre and in some respects since the Cultural Revolution domestically, but also the most aggressive foreign policy that we've seen in many years. I think also, as well as being signs of his ambition and the regime's ambition, I think these are also signs of the regime's weakness as well. I think they are more and more insecure, particularly as China's own domestic economy slows down, the impact of the pandemic domestically. And I think they are sort of thrashing around in a fury out of their insecurity.
Right. One of the other things I was going to ask, and you're sort of getting there, is the idea of that this is a part of response to countries in the West saying we'll pay or otherwise incentivize American countries, American companies, the British doing the same, to remove their supply chains from China and onshore them or locate them in other countries in Southeast Asia, but get them out of China. And China needs to react to that sort of economic antagonism, as they, I'm sure they see it.
Yes, that's right. I think they are feeling increasingly under pressure. I also think there's one other dimension to this, which is that for too long, until fairly recently, for too long, the West has been too soft on China and on the Chinese Communist Party regime, and naively thought that our economic engagement with them would lead to liberalization in China. And we're just waking up because of the effects of the pandemic. Although, to be fair to the U.S. administration, of course, the U.S. was waking up before this. But we're all of us are just waking up to the dangers of the Chinese Communist Party, not only to their own people, but to the rest of the world. But had we been a bit tougher on them earlier on, we might not be in this situation now. It's a bit like dealing with a bully. And if you stand up to a bully, they usually back down. Whereas if you fail to stand up to them and actually kowtow to them, to use the Chinese expression, as I think too many countries have been doing, they're emboldened and they think they can go even further. And that's how we've ended up where we are today.
He is Benedict Rogers, human rights activist, journalist, and co-founder and chair of Hong Kong Watch. Benedict Rogers, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. So in April, the New York Times Magazine ran a cover story, the diary of an ER doctor in New York City. And this was part of the sort of the dystopian world that COVID-19 was creating, and the discussion of the stress on the New York City hospital system. And again, the epicenter of the outbreak in America, serious matter, and a lot of panic was afoot. The piece reported on the death of a 26-year-old doctor, medical resident in training. Well, it turns out that report was inaccurate. The doctor didn't die, didn't even have COVID. The New York Times literally is trafficking in dystopian fiction. And they did so at the height of the panic that was afoot, as foundationless as it generally was. Editor's note, a month later, May 26th, this was caught by an alert tweeter. May 26th, 6 weeks later, an early version of our article described an account that circulated among doctors in April about a 26-year-old medical resident training in New York who was said to have died of COVID-19 in a New York City hospital. This account was verified with sources involved in the patient's care, but further reporting after publication revealed that it was a case of mistaken identity. According to a spokeswoman for the American College of Emergency Physicians, a 26-year-old man who died from complications related to the coronavirus had the same name as a young medical resident at a different hospital. Health workers involved in the patient's treatment mistakenly believed he was a medical resident, American College of Emergency Physicians said it had subsequently confirmed it was not the same man and that the medical resident with that name was healthy. The reference to the case has been removed from the article. Well, that makes it better. No worries double-checking, triple-checking such a story like that with the impact that you know it would have. But when you want to believe something, you're less likely to verify it, aren't you? And thus the general statement about the lack of intellectual curiosity in the D.C. press corps, particularly at its signature outlets like the Gray Lady. I mean, why don't they just get rid of Dean Baquet and bring back Jason Blair for a true professional fictionalist to write these stories, not news, stories. Just remarkable. And there will be about as much accountability for the New York Times with among their brethren as there will be politicians in blue states among their electorates, I suspect, and I'm sorry to say, for something that you can count on that is truthful and verified. Watch No Safe Spaces, the number one political documentary of 2019 that's produced by our friend Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla, documenting truthfully, accurately, the assault on free speech on college campuses, social media platforms, and in Hollywood. For a limited time, you can use the discount code SAVE25 for 25% off No Safe Spaces. You can stream it at nosafespaces.com, and that 25% off and that discount code SAVE25 also allows you to watch as many times as you want through this weekend, through the end of May, May 31st. So check it out, No Safe Spaces at nosafespaces.com.
From the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Don't get this often at theatlantic.com, so I want to take judicial notice of it. A rather depoliticized human moment from a second wave feminist opining at the Atlantic, Robin Moraine's Heinig. I miss my grandchildren. One of the very few benefits of being in my 60s is that I can finally own up to a trait that's pretty retro, that what I cherish most in life is my family. I might endanger my credentials as a second-wave feminist with this admission. Oh, the horrors. But I've come to realize that the pleasure I get from being with my daughters, their husbands, and my granddaughters outshines whatever pride I take in my writing career. I'll drop everything to see my granddaughters, age 2 and almost 5, even if it means ignoring a looming deadline. So when people talk about how the pandemic should make us slow down and learn to appreciate what really matters in life, the advice strikes me as a cruel, unfunny joke. I already know what matters in life. The pandemic isn't clarifying that for me. It's ripping it away. Lives versus lives, as it's always been, and not just in terms of survival, but in terms of quality. Again, one of the things we pretend we don't do in this era of politicizing viruses, we pretend we don't make judgments based on quality of life. And it's most interesting to watch those who are otherwise proponents of euthanasia, if somebody gets a hangnail and feels like they can't go on, talking about saving lives, and that's their stock and trade. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Conrad Black, financier, columnist, member of the British House of Lords. Conrad Black, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
It strikes me as the op-ed in The Atlantic from Ms. Heinig sort of folds into your op-ed in amgreatness.com about the Democrats running out of arguments. They don't have the science on their side, and frankly, they just don't have sort of the visceral public reaction on their side when it comes to things important in life, whether it's livelihood or, as Ms. Heinig is writing, family.
Well, substantially, I think that's what's happened. They embraced the panic at the beginning, and in fairness, we didn't know, the scientists, nobody knew. So you couldn't say at that point that what they were saying was nonsense. But as the experience of it continued and the nature of it and the data generated by it was assimilated, it became clear that if we didn't shut down everything, the potential victims would be the people who would die in the United States. As that receded, they haven't altered their view with it. They appear to have embraced the panic opening and the consequent conclusion and stuck with that conclusion, even though the panic is receding. It is, of course, a serious illness, and it's something nobody wants to get. But as a practical matter, as a threat to the population, it's not statistically very significant. And we have to go to greater lengths to protect and segregate, in medical terms, the vulnerable people or the immunity-challenged ones. But that is a relatively small number of does not justify shutting down 80% of those who in fact have minimal risk or none. And, you know, they're left holding an argument that will not stand and will be steadily defeated as the weeks go by, it seems to me.
Did they also, for them, unfortunately, expose who they believe are the important people and what is important in America in a free society? And I speak to terms like essential and non-essential. I speak to realities like 40 million first-time unemployment filers over the last 10 weeks. That sort of hemorrhaging of employment in the private sector, while there's been virtually no impact in the government sector, in the public sector. And then, of course, you know, going to Walmart is essential. Attending a house of worship is non-essential. And it just really puts in very stark terms what the left believes are the important people and the important things in America.
Yeah, I think that you get that, but on a patchy basis. I don't think there's a central authority in the Democratic Party that decrees precisely what you just said. But the effect is very similar to what you said. One, they enjoy exercising the maximal authority. I mean, the faster reopening states are almost invariably the Republican-governed one. You know, they love having this authority. It is clear that the outright anti-theism, I don't mean just atheism, that's fine. The religion's a matter of preference to everyone, and everyone is free to have any views they want. Nothing wrong with that. But this desire, in effect, to punish and demean religious practice is unconstitutional in itself, but it is a whole practice, in my opinion, because it is an absolutely colossal affront to the freedom of conscience that is guaranteed. For them to say, well, liquor stores are essential but churches aren't, or gun and ammunition stores are but churches aren't, it's preposterous. And in any case, it's an ancient field of trespass that I thought we had resolved centuries ago, that the religious and secular authorities don't step on each other's toes.
Did President Trump rely on the experts too much? Was there too much reliance on the technocracy that even he fell prey to?
I don't feel comfortable criticizing something to take such he did under the pressure he was under. But I think he himself has said that if we'd known as much about this illness at the beginning as we do now, he would have done it differently. Mm-hmm. I think that the heat was on him so heavily, the media, who are essentially conducting this campaign for the Democrats. I mean, Biden is hiding in his basement and doesn't make any sense when you can get to him anyway. And the campaign for the Democrats is being conducted by the media, and they had whipped public fear up. And so I think he had to go along with it. I think he did the wise thing. He took on board scientists who then moved with him towards a relatively quick reopening, and he left the direct authority for reopening to governors and mayors, but is steadily trying to reopen on the basis of scientific data that can't really be contradicted. So he's had to sort of surf this thing a bit. I don't fault him for that. I think if he'd stood there against the blast of panic that he faced and said, we're not shutting down anything, and I don't agree with any of the scientists, he would have lost political capital and been able to maintain a moral authority to do what he's done.
I wanted to get your take on a pronouncement made by Attorney General Barr last week as it pertains to the ongoing Durham investigation and sort of the swirl about whether or not Obama or Biden were targets of the investigation. He basically said that from what he knows, they are not. But the more important statement he made was that he is not going to allow the Justice Department to be used as a tool for electoral politics, the way he clearly implicated it had been used previously by the previous administration during and even before the transition period. And, you know, this I think this was a wonderful statement among some conservatives, for some conservatives like me. I think that was exactly the right note to strike. We're going to reestablish the precedent that existed before President Obama's administration. But there are others, Trump supporters, who want an eye for an eye. Where do you fall?
I certainly don't want an eye for an eye, just terrible things were done to the Trump campaign and administration, and therefore they should be visited. They should be visited upon the former tenters. But I do want a judicial facts indicate they deserve it. I wouldn't prejudge that, and unlike most people, I actually do try and give everyone the presumption of innocence and the benefit of the doubt. But I am not sure if the Attorney General was saying, as of now, I don't see this happening, no matter how involved they were. He had some phrase like that, no matter what the level of their involvement or something like that. And so that's a matter for the voters to decide. But Obama doesn't have to face the voters again. And I mean, I think that would apply with Biden, assuming he is. But the I think it did succeed at getting the Democrats off Barr's back. They had been complaining loudly, as you know, that he was essentially a lackey of the president's. But when he appeared as the sole guardian of what's left, when former President Obama's threadbare legacy, that they've laid off him now. So it may have been tactical. I just have no standing to judge exactly what he meant, where there's a gray area there. And he, as I understood it, he was speaking at the president. He wasn't saying this couldn't change if the facts that were used justified a change.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But even the declaration he made based on what he knows, you know, at the time of speaking, and then we'll see what the report actually produces and the recommendations contained therein. It was still newsworthy, so I just wanted to get your take. He is Conrad Black, financier, columnist, member of the British House of Lords. Conrad Black, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dan.
Take care.
Have a good weekend and all your listeners.
Thank you.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. I want to go back to a piece I referenced earlier in the show from Josh Holmes, former chief of staff to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Just this idea that Americans haven't felt the full brunt of the economic pain and suffering that will be felt from the lockdown policies over the last 3 months. Holmes writing in the Wall Street Journal, if your family hasn't lost a loved one to COVID-19, your bank account probably looks basically the same, and you believe your job is awaiting your return, which, again, 3/4 of Americans do. The past 10 weeks have been an extended inconvenience, and so people have largely been frozen and generally content to be frozen because they haven't felt the punishment, and which is an odd thing to say against the backdrop of 40 million first-time unemployment filers over the last 10 weeks. But there again, I'm on filing for unemployment for now. It's going to get me through, maybe do even better than get me through. And then I believe 3/4 do that. Why my job will be there on the other side. Well, many people are under a mistaken belief that it will be. And so I referenced that piece today. And we talked a little bit about our next guest piece, Get Ready for the Careful Economy, yesterday. So now let's meld the two. John Cochran, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, the Grumpy Economist, joins us now. John, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
So so we get the data today, 13% drop in consumer spending in April, which is a record, but 10.5% increase in personal income in April because of the government stimulus. And so to Josh Holmes's point that right now people are still insulated through government subsidy from the pain, but it's coming and it may last longer than some people want to believe it could because of what you wrote about, which is the piecemeal reopening, the careful reopening, which cuts against the genius of the American economy, as you write, our efficiency.
That's right. Let me take a halfway point between the two.
Okay.
Although that never makes for good radio.
That's all right.
I think it's not as doom and gloom as one might think. There will be a quite swift recovery as businesses that have not gone bankrupt are allowed to reopen. And they'll hire back a lot of people. Then we end up kind of muddling along in a not great situation because of all the combination of the extra costs of protecting against the disease and the large swaths of businesses that are going to stay closed for a long time as people have closed or on a very reduced level because people are still scared of the virus. So, you know, restaurants, airlines, things like that are going to be slow for a long time.
Well, right, and also too, you have this other sort of secondary layer of issue in terms of the quickness of the recovery, which is different states are opening up at different paces, and so when you have big states like Illinois and New York and California and New Jersey lagging behind other big states like Texas and Florida and Georgia, that makes for sort of an uneven dynamic, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I don't want to be too optimistic. No, we should say there's a lot of uncertainty here. We don't know what's going to happen. There's a rosy scenario where things bounce back quickly by the fall, and we go, "Whew, that was nice." So that was horrible, and we're done. But things could also get a lot worse if the recession just keeps going. Then, as you mentioned in your intro, a lot of the things that have been done to prop things along fall apart. The government can't pay everybody's bills for 6 months to a year. They can't pay every business's bills and stop every business from going bankrupt for 6 months to a year. So if the economy stays low into the fall, a lot of the things we've sort of had a cold and taken a couple cappuccinos, but those cappuccinos will wear off by fall if the economy doesn't start bouncing back pretty quickly.
And then, one of the other questions, too, is what does a reopened America look like? Is it one where there are some silver linings that are hoped for that materialize, like less regulation that could speed the recovery and the creative energy of a market economy? Or is it going to be one where some of the government expansions of power remain and that retards the recovery, retards economic growth?
Yeah, there's a big question. Well, I would say that depends on us, the voters.
Right.
Because it could easily go in both ways. We certainly, I think all of us have learned, even some of my friends on the deep left have been a little bit shocked with how incompetent the regulatory state has been, how much regulations on, you know, things like face masks. You can't just sell face masks. Heavens no, they're not properly certified and so forth. So I think there is some hope for a deregulatory aspect. Also because our economy has to not just grow back to what it was, it has to shift there's lots of job openings as well as jobs being closed down. People have to move to doing different things. But then there's the tendency to more and more government. And you can certainly see, hey, everybody's getting free money from the government. Why don't we just live on free money from the government forever? And the politicians who dole that out would be very happy to keep that project going.
Well, then do you, Jason Furman, who is an Obama economic advisor and is now at Harvard, He made some waves this week via a Politico story, which recounted his presentation to a bipartisan group of big shots, where he basically said, I'm looking for third quarter numbers like America has never seen, positive numbers. You're going to see, because of the depths of what the second quarter are going to look like, you're going to see numbers in the third quarter that dwarf any growth numbers America has ever seen. And so he's very optimistic about something approximating a V-shaped recovery. And that's an Obama economic advisor.
Yeah. And I salute Jason for his honesty on that. Now, it depends whether you look at growth rates or levels. When you've fallen off a cliff, climbing back up the other side looks like great growth. But do you get back to where you were?
Yeah,
I think that's very likely. You know, if you'd looked at growth rates into Christmas holidays and then back out again, you'd see a big fall over into Christmas and then a big growth again in January, early January of the year. But do you get back to where you were? So I think we will see that initial spurt of growth, and then the big question is, how quickly do we get back to where we were, or do we trundle along kind of going slowly for a while after that?
Is there any sector that you're watching particularly to that may be a leading indicator of how this is going to go, whether it's banking or manufacturing, even the healthcare sector with the shape financially that many hospitals appear to be in?
That's a good question. So I don't spend my life tracking data. I love the guys who are tracking movement data. So the most, if you want to look at the most up-to-date numbers, the credit card data and the stuff that tracks people's GPSs and sees where they're going, and all of that suggests that things are on the rebound fairly quickly. I would say the other thing is it depends also where our government goes. If they decide that they need a huge stimulus and start pouring money at it, I think that will be unfortunate because we need the machinery of the economy to work, not just pouring more and more onto the national debt.
He is John Cochran, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. John, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's always been a pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Money.
Grab that cash with both hands and make a stash. New car caviar for stash.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Dan Henninger writing in the Wall Street Journal this week. The past week's events, talking about the reopenings at their various stages and paces around the country, the past week's events have revealed one rule of thumb. Whether the order comes from political leaders, epidemiologists, or the media, you can get away with forcing the U.S. to shut down for about 3 months, but that's it. Then the tides of human nature will push past the voices of authority. For better or worse, that's just the way it is. That's one of the takeaways Henninger sees from the last 3 months, thinking ahead, as we should be, to the prospect of a second wave of the virus in the fall and winter and what the policymakers' reaction will be. And also, probably good news, what Dan Henninger is saying, if that is indeed the case, because the Fed issued a financial stability report just a week ago warning asset prices will be vulnerable to, quote unquote, significant price declines should the pandemic persist. And by the pandemic persisting, they're really talking about our reaction to it, meaning these lockdowns. It's time to move. And Americans, I think, are getting that, have an innate sense that that is indeed the case, particularly with perhaps a more informed understanding of what the relative risks are. For more on the topic and continuing our conversation that we started before the news with John Cochran from the Hoover Institution, continuing our conversation about the economic recovery and what needs to be done and what preparations need to be made for what eventualities could come to pass. We're pleased to be joined by Thomas Vartanian. He's a former bank regulator, currently executive director and professor of law of the Program on Financial Regulation and Technology at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School. Professor, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I was interested in a couple of pieces that you penned for The Hill over the last couple of weeks. And you begin by talking about that second economic shoe were to drop, were there to be another wave of the virus in the fall and winter, as is under discussion. What are the preparations that should be made? Much of the talk has been on the public health side. You talk a little bit about what needs to be made on the fiscal and monetary side, and what Congress must do to avert a collapse in such a scenario. So why don't you outline your recommendations for us?
I think the problem is we're fighting an enemy that we don't know and we don't understand. It's COVID-19. And so we don't know how long it's going to persist, whether it comes back or not. And the problem that creates for the economy is that institutions and companies can only hold out so long without revenue. Now, the government has done a terrific job through the Fed and the Treasury of injecting enormous amounts of cash through the various programs that have been set up. But the problem will be at some point, if businesses stay shut and they don't have revenue, there's only going to be so much credit that the government can make available to them. But at some point, they're going to start closing up their doors and failing. And the problem with that is that if the bankruptcy courts are overrun by too many bankruptcies of mid-sized to large companies, it's going to cause some real strains in the economy. And those strains are only going to be exacerbated by the fact that for those companies to get out of the organization in bankruptcy, they have to have debtor in possession financing, meaning they have to be financed while they're in bankruptcy and restructuring to get out. And the likelihood of that in that scenario reduces every day. So my conclusion is, based on many of the other crises we've had in this country, some of which I handled or was involved in, and many of which I've researched for a book I'm writing over the last 2 years, is that the government should be prepared for the worst, because we don't know what's going to happen. And the worst here could be a solvency problem for thousands, tens of thousands of corporations in the country. And I think the government ought to think about putting together a revitalization finance corporation, much like occurred in the Great Depression in 1932 through the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. So that entity would be available to buy preferred stock equity instruments from companies to keep them solvent and keep them around while we work through this pandemic. And the other attractive aspect of that is that right now the banks are solvent and well-capitalized. And a lot of that is because of the higher capital requirements that were required after the last crisis. But again, that's only going to last for so long. If your borrowers aren't paying you, eventually you start losing a lot of money, and that starts chipping away at your capital. And if we end up with a situation where the banks are losing capital, then we've got a real problem.
I want to pick up this conversation about, first comes the liquidity crisis, then the solvency crisis, and one way to prepare for such a happening. More with George Mason University law professor Thomas Vartanian right after this. So give a little bit, oh, give a little bit
of your time to me. Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're speaking with Thomas Vartanian, former bank regulator, currently executive director and professor of law of the program on financial regulation and technology at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School. And we were talking about the concerns if the economy doesn't reopen relatively soon, if there's a second wave that causes a second shutdown or partial shutdown, that a liquidity crisis could beget a solvency crisis, could beget real troubled times economically for a long time to come. So just to get the sequencing right, liquidity crisis then can beget a solvency crisis. But the liquidity crisis right now has been addressed by all of the facilities that the federal government has funded for the Fed, giving them those tools in the toolbox that Jerome Powell likes to talk about, $6 trillion worth of tools. But even there, like with the stimulus checks on the fiscal side of the house, that was all based on sort of a 10-12 week projection in terms of shutdown, where that is not those are not the resources required to maintain liquidity beyond 3 or 4 months at the most.
That's absolutely correct. I think what we've got now, solutions and good solutions that were crafted for a 3 month shutdown on the theory that this was a temporary problem. And it may well be a temporary problem, and I think everybody hopes it's a temporary problem and that the virus recedes and does not come back. The problem is, if it does, we will have two real problems to deal with. One will be a fiscal problem, and that is companies will continue to lose money. Liquidity won't be enough. They will lose net worth. They will lose their shareholders' equity and have to move towards bankruptcy. And the second will be the hit to public confidence that a second go-round here will have. And one thing I've learned in studying all of the financial crises over the last 200 years is they are all created by some lack of confidence and they are all ended by some rebuilding of confidence, usually by the United States government. In 1907, it happened to be J.T. Morgan. But usually there's something happens that rebuilds the confidence in the economic system. And confidence is the great intangible that makes the country's economy work.
Now, but before we get too far down the road on confidence, because I do want to explore that, but I want to go back to the banks. And so this is part of the confidence measure as well, or an impactor on confidence. And that is the saw that's been repeated throughout the crisis. We did not. This isn't like the Great Recession. We didn't have a banking crisis. We don't have a problem with the financial system. The financial system is strong. But if the shutdown continues, we could work our way into a banking crisis. And what that would look like if we were to see a financial collapse, a financial system collapse, or certainly it being significantly damaged because of the extent of the lockdown.
Yeah, so the way I think it could work, particularly if we had a second go-around or this last into 2021, is the banks right now have been admonished by the federal regulators. That's the Federal Reserve Board, the Office of the Controller of the Currency, and the FDIC, basically to provide forbearance to their borrowers who cannot repay loans because of the impact of the pandemic. Well, banks came into this this year with about 11% average capital, which is terrific relative to where they entered the 2008 crisis. So they're highly capitalized, can probably get through this year quite satisfactorily. But the problem becomes is if their borrowers aren't paying back their loans going into next year, forbearance only works on one side of the ledger. That is, it helps the borrower. But at some point, the banks have to have income to stay in business. And when they start losing money, they start writing off capital. And when they start writing off capital, the bank regulators have to close them when they get to a certain point. So the last thing I think we want is corporations going into bankruptcy and banks being closed because they're running out of capital. So, again, the best way to stop that before it starts occurring, because once it starts occurring, it's really difficult to control, is to do something like we did in 2008. In 2008, it was TARP. And that is an entity of the government, in that case it was Treasury, buying preferred stock instruments from companies and banks to make sure that they stay solvent and don't get to that precipice where they have to jump into oblivion.
Short of that, short of setting up that agency that you're suggesting, are banks right now able to weather the storm of a cratering of the commercial real estate market that you know, some are predicting based on, and I don't mean just based on the lockdown. I mean, based on sort of the new reality for the foreseeable future in terms of work life and economic activity in this country.
Yeah, that's a great question. You've got two real problems in terms of dysfunctionality in the marketplace that I see right now. One is commercial real estate and the other is residential mortgages. Both of which are suffering from the fact that there's no income coming in. So on the residential side, the CARES Act provided that borrowers who have federally backed mortgages from Fannie and Freddie can petition to forbear and not pay those for 1 year. Similarly, on the commercial real estate side, what's happening is, of course, people are not paying their rents and commercial developers don't have any income. So the question is, how long can the banks support that? And I think the banks are highly capitalized. And frankly, the reason why they were ordered to build up all this capital after 2008 is to be able to use it in a crisis and support the economy. So the question again is, how long does that support hold out? And I think it's a function of how desperate the commercial markets become. And that means the longer the pandemic stays around, the longer people are shy about going back into their buildings and the longer it takes to get businesses back in business, it's going to continue to chip away at the capital that the banks have. And I think, again, they probably have enough capital through this year to support businesses and borrowers through this pandemic. But if we're in 2021 talking about the same sort of issues, that's going to be problematic for the banks.
He is Thomas Vartanian. He is a former bank regulator. He's the executive director and professor of law of the program on financial regulation and technology at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School. Professor Vartanian, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Take care.
The more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. There's only so much heavy lifting Chris Cuomo can do for his brother, Andrew. He needed to call in the big guns for his press briefing, which is remarkable, actually. Andrew Cuomo bringing Chris Rock and Rosie Perez in for his daily coronavirus briefing, the epicenter of the outbreak. We're here to listen to a comedian and a C-level actress, even if she was an A-level actress. What does that have to do with anything? Anything related to infectious disease or public policy? So in come Chris Rock and Rosie Perez in full latex glovery. First, Chris Rock.
I watch you every single day. You bring me calm, you know, you bring me joy. Didn't Aretha, Anita Baker sing that? You bring me joy every single day, because I don't know what's going on. I thought I lived in the United States. I thought I lived in a country, and now I realize that we have 50 countries, essentially. Right now, we're in the country of New York. I got the test today. I just got tested to come out here. I got a 65, so just
passed.
I'm old enough to remember when Chris Rock was funny and edgy rather than being a sycophant to a political class. He brings Chris Rock joy to Andrew Cuomo. I guess Chris Rock isn't a nursing home resident, huh, Chris? There's a civics lesson for Chris Rock, 50 New York country, huh? Well, guess what, Chris? A lot of New York countrymen, your fellow countrymen, they're renouncing their citizenship. I don't know if you've seen. And that brings us to Rosie Perez, and it gets even dumber.
Do the right thing. Put your mask on.
I see what
Come
you
on,
did there.
Yeah. But, you know, I also see what really boggles my mind. You know, we talk about how the communities of color, communities of low income and poor, when you step into the communities that are affluent, where you see hipsters and yuppies walking around without a mask, I go, what is it? Is it arrogance? Is it an arrogant, defiant act that you're doing? Do you think that you are not going to be affected? Okay, fine, that's your thing. But you're affecting me, too. And that I really do not understand. And people are not talking about that.
We are talking about it. What you don't understand is it's not defiance unless it's defiance against ignorance. Yet another study restating what we already know to be true. Study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine last month finds that both surgical and cloth masks provide ineffective prevention of the spread of COVID-19. Quoting the researchers, neither surgical nor cotton masks effectively filtered SARS-CoV-2, that's COVID-19, during coughs by infected patients. And there are many other numbers of studies and medical professionals we've cited. So that's why. And as Alex Berenson mentioned on last night's program, if you know, just go along with pseudoscience, just to get along, to do virtue exhibitioning like Rosie Perez wants you to do, then what you're essentially facilitating is the redefinition of science as politics by other means. And you just don't want to do that. Thank you for joining us on another installment. Have a great weekend, and let's pick it up next week, Monday, when, oh, by the way, the great John Hindraker from Powerline Blog sits in for me Monday, and I'm back Tuesday. Have a great weekend.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.